Welcome to the podcast of the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau. My name is Brian Mason, and I'm the minister of this congregation. I'm joined this morning by Donica and Margaret and Julie, and we are happy that you decided to worship with us this morning. As many of you already know, this year marks the 150th anniversary of the founding of our church. In recognition of this congregation's rich history, I've been digging into the archives in search of sermons by the church's former ministers to re-preach. So far, we've heard from John Robinson, Brainerd Gibbons, Glenda Walker, myself, and this morning we will hear from Glenda again. It's not that there aren't sermons by other former ministers. In fact, I'm particularly excited to re-preach Noble McLaughlin's sermon about a universalist being abducted by aliens and therefore spreading the message of universalist Christianity into the cosmos. But I will save that for another day. I've decided to re-preach another one of Glenda's because I think it's fitting. Glenda served this church for 10 years as minister and another 20 as minister emerita. In a way, Glenda's ministry is a bridge between the 20th and the 21st centuries. And as many of you know, this past February, Glenda died in her home at the age of 87. Glenda came to UU Wausau in her late 50s. She literally invested almost everything she had to become a minister. When I read through Glenda's sermons, I hear rare wisdom and candor. Glenda's reputation was that of someone who was unaware of the business side of church, someone who didn't know a thing about buildings and budgets and so on. And maybe that's true, and maybe not. What I do know from reading through a decade of Glenda's sermons is this. She was a heck of a minister, someone who read widely, prayed intensely, and was truly called. Glenda is a minister I hold in the highest regard. She wouldn't be comfortable with all that I'm saying right now, but it's true. I wish Glenda were alive today because she's someone I'd call on in this time of social distancing and COVID-19, and I bet there are a few of you who feel the same as me. But second to that, we can listen to Glenda tell us in her own words some of what she learned in life and living. I'm privileged this morning to re-preach the sermon she offered to this congregation on June 13th, 1993, on her 60th birthday. You will hear her speak of her former husband, Richard, and her two children. She will speak of regrets as a spouse and parent. She will speak of her weaknesses and failures. But she will also speak with wisdom and humor. It's no wonder she was honored by this congregation upon retirement. I hope all of you will enjoy a bit of Glenda's insights again this morning. And with that, let us gather our hearts and minds for worship. Wherever you are welcome to join us in our opening hymn this morning. Come sing a song with me. Thank you. If you're following along at home, please join me in our chalice lighting. We light this chalice for the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the fire of commitment. We light this symbol of our faith as we gather together. And now our doxology.
Was a farm in a valley that was practically perfect in every way, except that it had no rooster to crow at the crack of dawn, and so everyone was always getting late getting up out of bed. The dog never woke up in time to fetch the newspaper for the farmer. The farmer never woke up in time to milk the cows before the sun rose. The cows never woke up in time to eat the grass when it was still wet with morning dew, which is when it's most tasty. Everyone was always late on that farm, and so everyone was always a bit cranky in the morning, and sometimes that crankiness lasted all day. But one day, a chicken arrived on the farm. Everyone was excited because she had four little yellow balls of fluff peeping and cheeping behind her. Pardon me, Mrs. Chicken, said the pig, who was always very polite. But would one of your chicks there happen to be, might one be a he? Why, yes, answered Mrs. Chicken. And she pointed the tip of her wing at the last chick in line. That is my son. A rooster chicken, squealed the young lambs, and all the other animals squealed or whinnied or quacked or oinked, too. We won't be late anymore. We have a rooster on the farm. But they didn't yet. They had to wait for the chicks to grow up, and they did. Those little yellow balls of fluff with legs no bigger than little stems to big yellow fluff balls with legs. As the days passed, all the young chickens grew fine white feathers and bright yellow feet. And then finally, young Mr. Rooster Chicken began to grow long swooping feathers on his tail. Everyone was so excited and told the young rooster often that they couldn't wait for him to grow up and crow every morning. Well, this was a lot of pressure for the young rooster. Everyone was so excited, but he was mostly worried. What if he wasn't any good at crowing? So he felt worried and sad. One day, his friends noticed that he seemed a little down, and they asked him what was wrong. He tried to tell them nothing, that everything was fine. But his friends knew him better than that, and they asked again. The young rooster was quiet and scratched in the dirt with his strong yellow toes. Finally, he took a big breath and said, "Everyone's waiting for me to grow up and crow. I'm doing the growing up part, but I don't know how to crow. I've never even heard a rooster. I don't know what I'm supposed to do." "We shall help you," announced the pig, who was always exceedingly helpful in addition to polite. "We will?" asked the cat. "How?" "Yes, how?" quacked the duck. "We shall teach him," said the pig. "You have heard a rooster crow before, have you not, Mrs. Duck?" "Well, yes, I have," said the duck. "I can show you." She flew up to the top of the chicken coop nearby. Then she folded her wings back, tilted her bill up, and... Now, if we were all here together in the sanctuary, this is where I would ask all of you to help me with this story. But we can't be together. Luckily, I do have some friends here with me today. So, Danica, what do you think it would sound like if a duck tried to crow?
Quack, quack, quack!
The other animals didn't think that sounded quite right, so they thought they all better help. Next, the cat gave it a try. Margaret, what do you think that sounded like?
Meow, 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 meow.
And then the pig. The dog tried next.
Woof, woof, woof.
And then finally the lamb. The animals had tried their best, but none sounded quite right. And the rooster sadly shook his head. "I'll never learn how to crow. I won't be any good at waking people up, and no one will like me anymore." "Sure we will," said the cat. "I like you right now, and you've never crowed a day in your life." All the other animals agreed. "Besides," added the cat, "I don't want you to wake me up. I like to sleep late." The wise pig thought for a minute and then mused. "I wonder, have you yourself ever tried to crow, Mr. Rooster?" "Me? But..." "Well, you're more rooster than any of us," said the duck. "And we'll like you no matter what you sound like," said the pig. "Even if you don't make any sound at all," said the cat. So the rooster decided to try. He flew up to the top of the chicken coop. He folded his wings back. He tilted his head and... After that, no one had any doubt that young Mr. Rooster knew how to crow, not even Mr. Rooster himself. There was a farm in a valley that was practically perfect in every way. It even had a fine young rooster who crows at the crack of dawn, and so everyone always gets out of bed exactly on time. The dog wakes up in time to fetch the newspaper for the farmer. The farmer always wakes up in time to milk the cows before the sun rises. The cows always wake up in time to eat grass when it's still wet with morning dew, which is when it is most tasty. Everyone is wide awake on that farm because they have a rooster whose friends helped him learn how to crow. So here's what I think about this story. First, ask for help when you need it. When you feel worried or nervous or overwhelmed or scared, ask someone to help you. I'm glad I asked my friends to help me today, and I'm glad that they did. Second, try new things. Even if you've never seen it done, and no matter what age you are, take a risk and try something new. When you're brave and try that new thing, you might find that you're actually really good at it. I miss you. I hope you're well there at home. Please take good care of each other this week.
Wherever you are this morning, I ask that you join me in a time and in a spirit of prayer and meditation. Take just a moment to clear your mind. Let us journey into silence with these words. Holy Comforter of the fearful and heavy laden, Spirit of hope that springs from nothing like giving birth to stars and so much more, Holy Mystery that sustains us even in the midst of fear and pain, we've brought our pain and fear into this hour today. We hurt from illness and the fear it generates. We ache for those caught up in war and violence. We can't let go of fears that those we love will suffer. And there is often not much we can think to do. At times our hearts are full of grateful thanks for all the wonder of this life. And then we learn that someone else is stricken, or that violence has flared again, or flood and famine are rampaging, battering what little hope is left for those caught in the path. We've learned that times like these are very difficult to face alone. And so we've come together to ask for comfort, help, and healing. Hear now our prayers for those in pain and need and for ourselves, for we have come to know that we won't make it on our own. Let us meditate in silence together now. Amen. Please join in singing Spirit of Life.
Today's reading is by Jenny Joseph. It's titled, Warning. When I'm an old woman, I shall wear purple, with a red hat that doesn't go and doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin sandals, and say we've no money for butter. I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired and gobble up samples in shops and press alarm bells and run my stick along the public railings and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in slippers in the rain and pick flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit. You can wear terrible shirts and grow more fat and eat 3 pounds of sausages at a go, or only bread and pickle for a week, and hoard pens and pencils and beer mats and things in boxes. But now we must have clothes that keep us dry, and pay our rent and not swear in the street and set a good example for the children. We must have friends to dinner and read the papers. But maybe I ought to practice a little now, so people who know me are not too shocked and surprised when suddenly I am old and start to wear purple.
Living a Life is Like Peace in a Quilt by the Reverend Glenda Clare Walker. Aunt Jane of Kentucky said, "Did you ever think, child, how much piecing a quilt is like living a life? And as for sermons, why, there can't be no better sermon to me than a patchwork quilt, and the doctrines is right there a heap plainer than they are in the catechism." I've made two quilts in my life. One is a lap quilt. I made it in a quilting class. There are only 9 squares in that quilt, and every square is a different pattern. My other quilt is a simple flower quilt. Each square is the same, except that the petals of the flowers are of different fabrics. The fabrics I used for the petals were from the sturdy parts of old dresses and blouses, from old shirts of Richard's, from scraps of fabric that my sister-in-law Jean and my mother-in-law Frances gave me. Jean and Frances enjoyed watching the quilt take form. They reminisced about the fabrics. Jean pointed at one scrap of flowered print and said, "That was the blouse I made for Janie's 6th birthday." Frances pointed at another and said to Jean, "That's the fabric I made your prom dress from." They reminisced about Janie's 6th birthday party and Jean's junior prom. The flower quilt was going to be for our double bed, but I ran out of patience. I don't have the same patience for stitching a quilt that I have for stitching a sermon, so when I had enough squares to cover a single bed, I finished the quilt. The quilt is obviously the work of an amateur. It's lumpy, it doesn't lay flat, the stitches aren't even. Now, instead of stitching fabrics with memories into a quilt, I stitch the fabric of memory and experience and understanding into sermons. And today, on the occasion of my birthday, I piece together a patchwork of essential learnings, the learnings of 60 years. My quilt of learning isn't perfect. It's unfinished and lumpy. It's the work of an amateur. We're all amateurs in life. I've learned that there are 2 tasks for me as an individual in life. One task is to become my inherent self, the person I was born to be in terms of temperament and skills. The other task is to transcend all the expectations and restrictions that others have laid on me and continue to lay on me that don't fit me. I've learned that it takes a long time to become a self, and it wouldn't take so long and it wouldn't be so hard if the people around me hadn't tried to mold me into what they thought I should be or what they wanted me to be. Sometimes it seemed like I was engaged in a constant struggle with others, dare I call it a battle, to be myself. In her 80s, Florida Scott Maxwell wrote, "I feel most real when alone, even most alive when alone." Better to say that the liveliness of companionship and the liveliness of solitude differ, and that the latter, the liveliness of solitude, is never as exhausting as the former, the liveliness of companionship. I've learned that the liveliness of solitude is the liveliness of being myself. When I'm alone, no one is asking or insisting that I be other than me. I'm free to be me, and that's energizing. I've learned that the liveliness of companionship is the liveliness of becoming myself or maintaining myself. Becoming myself is energizing when companions accept me as I am. Maintaining myself is wearing and even exhausting when companions refuse to accept me as I am. I have sometimes given up pieces of myself to stay in a relationship. That's difficult to do. Marriage and friendships and family relationships and even work relationships falter and fail when we can't be ourselves, and they thrive when we can. Another thing I've learned is that marriage and similar relationships are too often based on romance or infatuation, sex or dependency, escape from parents or desire for adventure. And those are inadequate bases for marriage and similar relationships. I've learned that when we don't leave our families of origin to be on our own and do the growing up that being on our own demands and allows, our immaturity is visited upon the marriage or similar relationship. And incidentally, in college, we aren't necessarily on our own, unless we're, in quotes, putting ourselves through. We're still dependent and living in a protected environment. I've learned that the failure of marriage or similar relationship rests on an inadequate basis for that relationship and the inability of both, and I underscore both, individuals to build a mature relationship with reasonable expectations. One person cannot do it alone. I've learned that divorce is not necessarily a tragedy. My own was not. Richard will agree. So will Holly and Paul, our children. Divorce is an occasion for grief. There is failure inherent in divorce. Failure that leaves us distraught and angry, confused and depressed. But failure is not the same as tragedy. And the failure of a marriage forces us, if we have the ability, to grow. Growth is no tragedy, even when it's painful. I've learned that when you have divorced and grown from the experience, you don't have to look on the disillusion of marriage as a tragedy. When you understand the reasons for the failure of the relationship and accept its disillusion, you're able to look back on the good in the relationship and celebrate it. An analogy that is imperfect and trivial, perhaps, is that marriage and divorce is like throwing a party. You do a lot of work to make the party successful, and it is for some people and not for others, and part of it is for you and part of it isn't, and when it's over, there's a mess and cleaning up to do. But you had a good time part of the time, and you're glad you had the party. Tragedy may be inherent in divorce when one doesn't learn from the failure and goes on to repeat the same mistakes with another partner. When I think of marriage and divorce, I think of Unitarian Universalist Rick Masden's poem, The Wedding Dirge, and the end goes like this. But remember this, more of us are seen crying at a marriage ceremony than at a funeral service, recognizing the sad fact, I think, that at a wedding we realize we could be in the presence of two free spirits dying. Now, I don't like the poem, it's pessimistic. And I don't believe more of us cry at a wedding than at a funeral. But there's truth in the poem, and I think about it sometimes when I'm in the presence of people whose spirits are dying in a marriage. I've learned most of us expect too much from marriage, and I admire the people whose marriages survive. I think they have realistic expectations of marriage and one another. I've learned a lot of things about parenting. Unfortunately, most of them at the expense of my children and too late to benefit them. Marge Percy, in her novel, He, She, and It, expresses the essential thing to know about becoming a parent. She writes, "As it is wrong to give birth to a child believing that child will fulfill your own inner aspirations, so it is wrong to create a being subject to your own will and control. It is inexcusable to create a sentient being for any other reason than to live its own life." And she continues, "Each of us wants to possess ourselves. Only fools willingly give themselves away." I often wish parenthood had to be earned rather than given freely by life forces. Parenting is our most important task, perhaps, for the fabric of society is built and maintained, rent, or destroyed by each generation. And unfortunately, most of us enter parenthood as amateurs, often with inadequate role models. I've learned that community is crucial to survival. When individuals let you down, if you have vested in community, the community will not let you down. It will nourish you and support you. I underscore if you have vested in community. I've learned that usually the community will not let you down unless you've let the community down. I've learned that the Ten Commandments are a very good guide for maintaining healthy community. I've learned that without respect and reverence for what some people call the natural order and others call Wakantanka, the absolute or God, we lose perspective. By whatever name we call it and however we describe it, without respect and reverence for that power and without respect for all the creations of that power, we destroy ourselves, one another, and everything that sustains us. Without respect and reverence for that power, we become miserly and inflated with presumed importance. With respect and reverence, we see the grandeur of the universe and the grandeur of our own lives, no matter how finite and painful they may be. I read in the May Atlantic that middle age extends roughly from ages 40 to 60. Though they suggested that increased longevity and better health may push back the period of middle age even further. That means that Joan Collins, Willie Nelson, and I are either on the cusp of old age or, depending on our health, have a few years to go before we reach old age. I read that same article that wisdom peaks in midlife or later. I don't assume my wisdom has peaked, but 60 years have taught me not to exploit others or to allow myself to be exploited, to set boundaries with others so that I and they know who I am and who they are, and so we don't mix up the two. That to be alone can be bliss, and to be lonely is okay. Loneliness has something to teach me about myself in relationship to myself, to others, and to God. That life is finite. And death, though an occasion for grief and mourning, is a condition that gives life meaning, a condition of the natural order. Death is a way of recycling energy from my perspective, and I find that comforting. 60 years have taught me that change, ambiguity, contradiction, and tension are necessary conditions of life, that few issues worth considering have only one side, that illusions are best when destroyed, that I can see life as a dance, or I can see life as a walk on a tightrope with heaven at the other end and the fires of hell below, and I prefer to see life as a dance. 60 years have taught me that decisions are always made with partial and imperfect knowledge and that I will therefore make mistakes, that grace abounds and that mistakes are not unalterable or unredeemable, that to take the risk of being myself and the risks of fulfilling that self lead to greater happiness, that those risks take courage, that people and community are the content in which I become a self, that I couldn't make it through life without friends and community, that as the old timer said, if life is good, it'll change. If life is bad, it'll change. 60 years have taught me that when I'm not myself, I have a shadow side that is quite likely to wreak havoc on others as well as myself. That Sir Lawrence Vanderpost is right. Evil comes into the world when we're not known for what we are and what we need. 60 years have taught me that life is hard work and life is sad, and there's no way to be prepared for all of it, but that life is still worth living for it holds joy. 60 years have taught me that if I measure myself against others or others measure themselves against me, they and I will be disappointed and even angry. 60 years have taught me that it's okay to be the prodigal daughter, but I wouldn't want to be without the daughter who stays home, that I must be patient with myself as well as others, that I must trust and move at my own pace as much as possible, and that I must respect the pace of others, that the process of life is what's important, not the goal, yet we must have goals, and that a sense of humor is indispensable, and to play is a necessity. 60 years have taught me that I most enjoy sitting in the quiet of my living room, reading a good book, taking a walk at sunrise, giving a compliment or a hug, learning something new, having a conversation with a friend, helping someone think, cuddling a baby, crawling into bed at night, tired, wrapped in flannel to sleep deeply and well. If I were to piece together a quilt today instead of a sermon, its squares would hold a couple dancing, a family together, a person alone, a group of children playing, children of all races, a flaming chalice, a Christian creche, a Star of David, a Buddha, a book, a sunrise, a lilac, a tulip, a daisy, a black cat called Catchy, a tree, probably a weeping willow, an autumn leaf, a snowflake, a burning candle, a sprig of holly, and the doctrines would be right there in the quilt, a heap plainer than in the catechism. The quilt, like my flower quilt, would be made up of the fabric of my life and the fabric of others' lives. It would be unfinished, for though I have learned to take more chances, to travel lighter and to spit, I have still to learn to limber up and relax, to take fewer things seriously. And maybe I ought to practice a little now that I'm 60, so people who know me are not too surprised when suddenly I'm old and start to wear purple with a red hat that doesn't go particularly well in the pulpit. Amen. Our closing hymn this morning is The Fire of Commitment. Reach out with your hearts. May the truth that sets us free and the hope that never dies, the love that casts out fear, lead us forward together until the day spring breaks and all shadows flee away.
Send you a joy.